Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's got a lot on its plate. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, this is a different kind of episode to usual because most of the time we focus on one particular area and try and examine that in detail. This week, we're going to look at six particular problems which we think are going to shape the world in the months and years ahead. So it's a bit of a dim summer, a tapas, if you will. So as I said, there are six problems have come out this week which we think will affect Britain and the world. We're going to start with the more globally ones and then go more parochial as the six problems progress. And we're going to start with Donald Trump, unusually because we've not really talked much about him this year, mainly just to try and preserve our sanity. We're also going to try talking about Donald Trump without alcohol, which, as you will know, is quite unusual in the Not Enough Champagne bunker.
Yeah, this is a dangerous experiment. We can't be held responsible for the results that follow.
So, problem number one, Steve, is Donald Trump is making policy on a whim. So we've seen two examples of this week. One of them was he has put massive tariffs on steel, almost to start a trade war, and tweeting things like trade wars are good. The second thing that's come out is quite a surprise announcement that he's going to meet Kim Jong-un in North Korea for denuclearization talks. So what are we to make of this particular problem?
The thing to focus on here is where these kind of policy announcements or these updates to diplomatic relations, seemingly, have actually come from. So on the whole trade wars angle, the reality is one of Trump's very few consistent political opinions is that he has been staunchly against globalization. This has held true for decades, regardless of whether he identified as being an independent, a Republican, or a Democrat. It combines a couple of bugbears for him. One, the rise of China. China is dumping steel into the international market. That is a fact. Which is impacting on steel production in other nations. The Port Talbot situation in the UK was partially a result of that. America, as a whole, has a much bigger steel industry than the UK does. There are a lot of jobs which depend on it. And given Trump's view of making America great again is all about jobs, jobs, and jobs, you can see exactly why this might appeal to him and certainly would appeal to a number of his voters. The impact of that remains to be seen. The EU have already basically said, if you do this, we will look to increase tariffs on Levi jeans, Nike trainers, and a few other bits and pieces, which are...
I think Harley Davidson's and whiskey.
Yeah, I think it was bourbon, which is... You know, an interesting little assessment of what Europe buys from America more than anything. But it's not going to likely change much of Trump's mind. What you might see happening is that as this situation progresses and maybe some more rational heads end up prevailing in the Trump White House, this probably isn't that likely given Trump's economic advisor Gary Cohn has left. Basically over this issue. You might see some adaptions to these tariffs where the EU will be excluded, the UK will be excluded, Canada will be excluded.
I suppose there's a few things there. You're right in that anti-trade and anti-globalisation rhetoric is something that's marked Trump out since the 80s. In the 80s, it was Japan that was the bugbear, and now it's China. In terms of his priority being jobs, 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 it's a particular kind of blue-collar jobs, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So it tends to be the steel industries or the miners, very kind of old-fashioned blue-collar. Not a lot of encouraging immigration over to Silicon Valley to help them, I would suggest. In fact, he signed the steel order surrounded with men wearing overalls and hard hats. It looked a little bit village people. In terms of what you're saying about the rational head in the Trump White House, I think one of the reasons why this problem will carry on is because actually the number of rational heads in the White House
is declining.
I mean, you mentioned Gary Cohen. It turns out Trump not condemning Nazism, that wasn't a red line, but tariffs. Gary Cohen had to take a principled stand there. Even Paul Ryan had to take a principled stand on that.
Yeah.
But I suppose the problem then is who is left. I mean, Hope Hicks has left, who was Trump's communications director, which presumably is connected with the Russia stuff that's going on, and she's seen as one of the people who could actually interpret Trump's moves to the outside world. It looks like it's just going to be Trump.
Yeah, well, John Kelly, his chief of staff, is rumoured to be on the way out. All kinds of rumours are doing the round that Trump is actually interviewing for his replacement already. I think we've got General Mattis, and that's about it these days.
H.R. McMaster, I suppose,
as well. Yeah, McMaster and Mattis are about the only kind of rational actors left in the White House.
And people are briefing against McMaster.
Those two figures actually link in quite nicely to the other thing we were talking about regarding Trump, which is the North Korean situation, where Trump has basically seemingly accepted a request by Kim Jong-un to have a face-to-face meeting in some capacity, or at least to have some form of official talks between America and North Korea. This seems to have been arranged with South Korea as an intermediary. That in and of itself isn't surprising. But the thing to take into account as to where this has all come from is that Trump is desperate, and I do mean desperate, to be validated on the international stage. He has not been taken seriously by basically anybody in any nation, likely as a result of his mood swings and the fact that, for the most part, his only real stance on anything is whatever the last person he spoke to told him to say. So people have just kind of started ignoring America. From Trump's perspective, being able to have that kind of face-to-face meeting with Kim Jong-un is a massive win. It's something Obama never managed to do. It sets him up as being better than Obama. He is arrogant enough to think that because he is the master of deals, he will be able to kind of leverage that into a good outcome for America in some form. Now, I do think one of the things that I do think is quite interesting about this is that Ian Martin, the right-wing journalist who operates the CapEx and Reaction websites, he basically said, quite correctly, I feel, that if Obama had done this, you know, there would be a lot of praise going his way. And I do actually think that would be the case. But because it's Trump, in this instance, people are being a lot more cautious about saying that this is a good thing. We don't know what's going to happen here. It's very interesting, regardless. But we all need to basically take a deep breath and calm down one way or another. This isn't likely to be anything major in either direction.
You're definitely right. Trump really wants to be loved and wants praise for something. And that's definitely one thing that motivates him. I do wonder if then those meetings will end up a bit like the televised deal-making sessions that Trump had with congressional Democrats and Republicans, both on immigration and on guns, where essentially it was pretty obvious that Trump had no idea what was going on and just agreed with every proposal that was put to him. And as you say, Trump thinks he's a master deal maker, but actually to be a good deal maker, you need to have knowledge of policy detail. And Trump doesn't have that. I think the other point I would make in terms of one of the things I think we've maybe got wrong on the podcast is we thought maybe the appointment of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State looked like quite a sensible move. It seems perfectly obvious. It seems clear now, actually, that Tillerson is useless. Mm-hmm. He's not spent any of the $120 million I think Congress allocated him to investigate Russian hacking. No real appointments have been made in the State Department to the extent where you've got people in Europe who they don't have a contact in the State Department to talk about issues with. And it was one of the things that Henry Kissinger said about Europe is that if I want to get Europe on the phone, who do I call? Well, it's almost got that. It's like the way around now that there's no one with very much foreign policy experience that they can get in touch with.
Yeah, and on that front with the State Department being a much diminished department within the White House infrastructure, that's where actually H.R. McMaster and General Mattis actually come into their own as basically the National Security Advisor and Secretary of Defense. They are playing a much bigger role in foreign affairs than probably a number of their predecessors have for quite some time. And that links up very strongly with the situation in North Korea. To be quite honest, you could easily see a situation where if McMaster or Mattis were to go, or both of them were to go, you would be losing two of the more rational members of the Trump cabinet. You know, you can disagree with them all you like on whatever, but they are professional soldiers and they don't take lightly to, you know, committing troops to things. But you could easily see if they were to go, them being replaced by somebody like, say, John Bolton, who would probably quite happily nuke North Korea as soon as sit down and have a meeting with them. By opening up these lines of communication, it also opens up lines of risk for Donald Trump, because he can be made to look a fool. I'm not saying he will be made to look a fool, but it is a possible outcome. And if Donald Trump is made to look a fool in some capacity, then he may very well lash out in some form. And you can't lash out economically against North Korea.
I don't think trade sanctions would work.
No. So the only other thing then is military sanctions, or, you know, some form of military engagement. So if we've not got McMaster, if we've not got Mattis, if we've not got Kelly in the White House anymore, then, you know, we increase the likelihood that some form of war between the US and North Korea could erupt, which is obviously quite a terrifying predicament in a number of ways, but it is something that does need to be taken into consideration.
Given that when there was an agreement to try and denuclearize Iran, that took 7 years and wasn't just America, it was Britain and the EU and other countries too.
Yep.
Watch this space. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that Russia is continuing to aggressively expand. This week, we've seen a story that's dominated a lot of the media, despite the fact, as Robin Pesson's pointed out, we only really know three facts, which are basically that there's Sergei Skripal, I believe his name is. Apologies to our Russian listeners for my pronunciation. And his daughter are seriously ill in hospital. Sergei Skripal was a Russian spy who came to Britain as part of a spy swap operation. And he appears to have been infected by some sort of nerve agent, but we don't know what nerve agent it is or who did it. But we're going to stick our neck out, listeners. We're going to say it's probably the Russians.
In this instance, I don't necessarily think it's what Peston says there is quite right. Yes, those are the three core facts we know, but we also know that Russia has a history of doing this to former spies and individuals that it does not like, Alexander Litvinenko being probably one of the most prominent examples of that, at least on British soil. Russia has a history in general of political assassinations, going right back to Ice Pick in the head for Trotsky. Can we imagine that Putin would do this? Absolutely we can. The real question becomes, what do you do about it? Because really, these sorts of actions are, again, a sign of an increasingly belligerent Russia that's desperate to try and push itself back onto the main stage of international relations. Largely because it is irrelevant in a number of ways. Its economy is not brilliant. Its economy is based solely around gas these days. And because of that irrelevance, that it is desperate to try and flex its muscles. Internationally, we need to come up with some form of response. And that is actually going to be very, very tricky. When Boris Johnson was giving his response, I believe it was in the House of Commons, mm-hmm. And can we just reflect on the absolute terrifying fact that Boris Johnson is responsible for dealing with this situation in the British government?
Thank heavens we have a steady hand on the tiller in this perilous international time.
Indeed. In Johnson's statement, he basically seemed to imply that there would be some form of repercussion and started talking about the World Cup. That was taken as a sign that maybe Britain would boycott the World Cup as a whole. That was then backtracked very, very quickly and turned into, well, we won't send anybody official to go and watch any of the matches, which is about as weak a response as you can get to these sorts of things. But really, even just not sending a team to the World Cup would be a very weak response to these sorts of things. But the problem is Britain can't, on its own, very easily make any stronger moves that would, without, you know, further antagonising the Kremlin.
If only we were part of some international trade organisation, some sort of trade bloc, some sort of union in Europe, if you would, that could maybe impose some sort of sanctions, Steve.
Indeed, if only we were a member of such a group. And you know what? For the time being, actually, we are. But we've burnt so many bridges within the past couple of years with the EU that actually it could prove very difficult for us to leverage any form of stronger sanctions against Russia. For no other reason than the fact that an awful lot of Europe is reliant on Russian gas. They are very, very weary of taking action that could antagonise the Russians into turning the gas lines off. That would have some negative repercussions for Russia, but given that they're going around politically assassinating people, I think we're beyond the stage where we shouldn't consider them capable of economic self-harm to make a political point.
Johnson said it was tantamount to an act of war, didn't he?
Yes.
And in response to that, we're going to make sure that Prince William doesn't watch England play its group stage matches, which, if I'm honest, if I was Prince William, I'd probably be quite happy with that. BuzzFeed have said, as you've said, assassinations are a big part of certainly Putin's foreign policy. 14 assassinations apparently since Litvinenko was killed in London since 2006. On the natural gas issue, I think maybe it's worth pointing out that last week when we had a massive cold spell and the beast from the east and all that kind of stuff, the National Grid put out warnings that Britain might be running out of gas and had to slow industrial gas production. If Britain becomes more reliant on Russia for gas in the future, it's going to be even harder to put in some sort of sanctions. And again, I don't think unilateral sanctions will work. It has to be at either a European level where we've got the leverage, or at an American level. And
Trump's not going to want to do that because reasons.
Indeed. Right, so that's number two. Number three, Europe's mainstream parties are fragmenting. So we've seen two examples of this week. We'll talk about the situation in Germany when we've actually got Charlotte Galpin on the podcast, because she actually knows what she's talking about German politics. But the Social Democrats in Germany have agreed to join Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats and the Grand Coalition. In response to that, the Social Democrats' poll ratings have gone below AfD, so now AfD are the second biggest party in Germany. Also, then, there were elections in Italy. They happened on Sunday. We got the results on Monday. And there, Matteo Renzi's party Democratica, which are the main centre-left party, and Silvio Berlusconi's right-wing, I think, Forza Italia, they both lost out to the Northern League and to the Five Star Movement, both of which are anti-Euro, both of which are quite populist. The Northern League itself, a little bit fascist in a few ways as well. That leads us to the collapse of mainstream centre-left and centre-right parties across Europe. We've seen PASOK in Greece now is hovering at 5 or 6%. The Socialist Party in France got 6% in the last presidential elections. The exception is Labour under Corbyn. I think we've talked a little bit about the reasons for that. Partly it's because of the electoral system. I also think a little bit of it is because Labour isn't in government and hasn't had to take difficult decisions for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And actually, a lot of the reason why these socialist parties have collapsed their support so much is because they have been in government and had to make some quite unpopular decisions.
Yeah, I think the other part of it boils down to the fact that people are not happy with the current system and they want to see it change. And rightly or wrongly, they are viewing the traditional parties as being, you know, not representing any meaningful change in any way. So when new opportunities do come along, they are champing at the bit to actually get involved with it in some capacity. So people are looking for something different. They are looking for somebody to provide answers. And I think one of the reasons in the UK actually is that we haven't necessarily seen that decline for Labour, as I think what you said holds very, very true. But I also think that in Jeremy Corbyn, what people are seeing currently are people who have rejected the current status quo. And that as a result of that, they're currently willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. Yes, first past the post helps achieve that. Yes, the fact that Labour hasn't been in government helps them massively as well. But I think because both McDonnell and Corbyn are in that more populist vein, which is what the bulk of this kind of rebellion against the traditional party seems to be about. It's not about left wing, it's not about right wing, it's about populism. Because they are seen as being as part of that populist vein, people are able to engage with them more.
And I've probably mentioned it on the podcast before, but one of the more prescient takes, I think, actually, on the election last year was from Gary Young, the journalist for The Guardian, who said that Labour was becoming a mixture of a populist and mainstream left-wing party. So essentially, a mixture of Syriza and PASOK. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think that's why, certainly electorally, Labour has done a lot better. What happens when Labour are in government, or if Labour are in government, and how you keep that coalition of 40 to 45% of voters together, I don't really know. But I suppose that's a problem for 2 or 3 years' time.
If you're lucky.
So there are three international problems. We're now going to go on to more parochial British issues. Problem number four, is that the media is continuing to be engaged in a culture war, which we've talked about on previous episodes. We've also talked about it on the Friday Fizz on our website, notenoughchampagne.com. Two wonderful examples of this week. One of them was the Sun story on Snowflake's misunderstanding Frankenstein, because they say that, and professors are telling them that somehow Frankenstein's monster was the victim in the story, which is almost like that's the point of the book. Then there's also the fascinating, I always thought it would be a fascinating thought experiment to see what would happen if Labour and the Tories had exactly the same policies. How would they be reported? Well, thankfully, we now have that because of the rise of Theresa May. So one thing that's been doing the rounds on Twitter this week are comparing the Daily Mail reactions to the exact same policy when Ed Miliband presents it and when Theresa May presents it. So when Ed Miliband comes up with an energy cap, the Daily Mail says it's back the bad old days, that it's reviving 70s socialism and Britain will be plunged into darkness. When May does it, it's a crackdown on energy rip-offs. Then similarly, Ed Miliband had a policy on making sure developers didn't sit on land and instead use it to build. Now, when Ed Miliband had that policy, it was Red Ed's plan to confiscate unused land, which was branded Stalinist, and a backlash grew against his plans to control the property market. When Theresa May does it, it's greedy property developers are told to use it or lose it, and Theresa May pressuring NIMBY councils. So, I suppose right-wing press has Tory bias shock, but what's the kind of deeper meaning, do you think, behind these two stories?
I'm not necessarily sure there's a deeper meaning other than the fact that the papers are responding to traditional market forces. People don't buy newspapers to stay informed necessarily. They buy newspapers to have their biases confirmed. There's a reason right-wing people buy the Daily Mail and the Sun, generally speaking, and there's a reason left-wingers buy the Eye and the Guardian. It's because they agree with them more. So when it comes to the reporting of those policies and the differences between how Labour is framed for when Labour suggests it and how it's framed when the Tories suggest them, it does not surprise me at all that that's how it is, because most of the readers of those papers identify with being on the blue team. And what the blue team does is good, broadly speaking, and what the red team does is bad, broadly speaking. The problem actually with all of this, at least from, I feel from the newspaper's perspective, is that kind of sounding their own death knell. The millennials are doing something daft, or hold a belief that is daft, or whatever, is quite a common refrain across right-wing media outlets. Throw in the fact that also these media outlets hold political opinions which most millennials don't share, and you end up in a situation where basically mine and your generation, Corey, are not going to buy the Daily Express, we're not going to buy the Daily Mail, because we've just got no interest in it, and we don't want to read articles about ourselves which are accusing us of being, you know, crybabies. What that means, though, is as the older demographics that buy these newspapers die off, the business models of these papers become unfeasible. They're not going to be necessarily picking up new readers in any form. And as such, you know, what you're actually probably seeing here is the dying thrashes and yells of papers who no longer have anywhere near as much influence as they used to and are going to continue to decline as things progress.
I think that's a really good point. I also think that actually what is killing the online business model for newspapers at the moment is the screen grab. Because it used to be the case that the Daily Mail did something terrible and then left-wing internet would link to it and say, look, come and click on this terrible story. Look mm-hmm. how terrible it is. Well, now you don't even have to click on it. Now what happens is someone takes a screen grab of it, shares it on Twitter. You don't need to go to the website and go for it. And that means you don't get the clicks, you don't get the ad revenue, which I think, as you say, like they're going for a model which in many ways is obsolete, even though it's only been going for about 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think the other problem is, okay, how are you going to fund the newspapers then? Well, I mean, two of the more successful papers that are running are the Times and the Financial Times. Now, they both have paywalls of one form or another. And I think it's very, very difficult for the Express, for the Mail and the Sun and so on. I don't think the people who read those papers are going to pay for a paywall. I mean, partly because just economically, though it tends to be, if you read those papers, you've probably got less income and therefore you've not got enough money to spend on a monthly paywall. But I think it's also, you will pay a paywall for quality journalism. So for the Times, you get the decent columnists, you get some good investigations. Same with the Financial Times. They did an investigation on the President's Club a few weeks ago. So they're moving into more proper investigative journalism. Well, no one's going to do that for the Daily Mail or do that for the Daily Express. A lot of the traffic that the Mail gets is gossip and US gossip. Well, they're not going to get enough places will do that for free and for clicks. No one's going to pay for that on the paywall.
You've hit the nail on the head there, because I do think that subscription model, putting stuff behind paywalls for the most part, but with some free articles available to everybody per month, is the way things are going to go. That's what the New Statesman is doing now. They announced last week that's what's going to happen there. Now, they're creating new content for subscribers. There's going to be a new podcast which Stephen Bush and John Elledge are going to be involved with, where they're going to look back at various prime ministers and things. It very much is a sign of where the industry is going. You've basically got two options. You go behind a paywall or you start begging for donations like The Guardian is.
Number five, again, it's something we've talked about quite a few times on the podcast, but we've seen this week that the Tories' austerity dilemma continues. Big economic news was that Britain now has a budget surplus. Austerity has worked. George Osborne and David Cameron were congratulating themselves. The only problem, of course, is that austerity has led to an estimated 120,000 deaths, according to one study. It's also led to Brexit, which the vote in part seems to be fueled by austerity. It also seems to have lost the Tories their majority because there's a backlash against austerity in the general election. It also seems to have caused the crumbling of a lot of our public services and infrastructure. So apart from that, guys,
resounding success.
Good job. Now, Nick Timothy, everyone's favourite election guru, he's come out and said, well, now we've got a budget surplus, Philip Hammond should end austerity. Spreadsheet Phil, our very gothic Chancellor Philip Hammond, he's got the March statement next week, and Nick Timothy's written an article in The Telegraph, which is behind a paywall, which saves us the problem of reading it, basically saying that the Tories should end austerity and spend more cash.
I mean, there's two things there. Well, first is, well, if you're going to spend more cash without going into deficits, which is what this past like 8 years or so or whatever has been about, then you need to increase taxes. And that's the long and short of it. Are the Tories actually going to increase taxes? I doubt it. And even if they do, they still don't have a differentiator versus Corbyn. In fact, all they'll be doing is Corbyn light, which, as we saw with Owen Smith's leadership campaign for the Labour leadership, being Corbyn light doesn't tend to get you very far.
Did we just compare Nick Timothy to Bantasaurus Rex?
I think we did.
Wow.
That's a new low, even for us.
Goodness knows how we got there.
But we did. And the other thing is just that, what happens to the Tories now if the economy is in a decent shape? Yes, you can still say, oh yeah, you can't let Labour threaten the state of finances.
You can say that, but then they tried that in 1987 and it didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. When people feel more secure and people feel economically like there are spoils to be redistributed, people vote Labour, or people tend to vote more left-wing. And that is something that the Tories are going to have to find a way to deal with. And currently, I don't think there is an easy option or easy solution for them. I think, actually, which is, as I may odd for feel odd saying this, I think technically Nick Timothy is right. They probably do need to turn on the spending taps in some form, but that does involve increasing taxation. And I actually think Nick Timothy's brand of conservatism would actually be fine with that, as long as it's the right sort of taxes going to the right sort of places. The issue is, Timothy's brand of conservatism isn't mainstream conservatism, and it's going to get ignored because of what he managed to do by costing them an election.
Yeah, I mean, there was a story in The Independent this week that 1 out of 10 local councils may run out of funds in 3 years because they literally cannot afford to pay for social care. You saw after the election May revert back to that Greece line where we have to continue with austerity because otherwise we'll end up losing our credit rating and becoming bankrupt. So I don't really see any change on that score. Sorry, Nick. Okay, issue number 6, last but by no means least, is that anti-Semitism in Labour is still a problem. A new iteration of the story this week. Steve has his head in his hands because he knows what I'm about to say. Jeremy Corbyn, it turns out, was a member of Palestine Live, which was a pro-Palestine group, and there were lots of posts in there about Holocaust denial. There was neo-Nazi propaganda posted in there. There were people who said that the Jews weren't a proper people. There was a very, very angry letter from Joan Ryan, who's MP, she's chair of Labour Friends of Israel, particularly lambasted Corbyn for organising an event with members of the group at which there were speakers including Max Blumenthal, who compared Israel to Nazi Germany and ISIS, and also James Thring spoke at that event, who thinks the world is controlled by a group of Jewish elders. This doesn't really tell us anything new that we didn't know before, because we knew that Jeremy Corbyn had anti-American foreign policy views and anti-Israeli foreign policy views, which means that he hangs out with some dodgy people and supports some dodgy people like Hugo Chavez. And we knew that, and it's one of the reasons why I've never voted for Jeremy Corbyn as leader, and it's something that really his opponents in both leadership contests should have made more out of. But we knew that already. He's also got some criticism for not challenging a lot of the abusive content that is on the site. But again, we also knew that Corbyn doesn't tend to challenge these kind of views. When we see, or doesn't tend to challenge maybe aggressive views. So when you see in 2016, he did an event with Ruth Smith, the Stoke MP, and Shami Chakrabarti. Ruth Smith was heckled. I think he was a Corbyn supporter. And Corbyn did nothing at that event to challenge that aggression, for all his wanting to champion a kinder, gentler politics. So in one hand, this doesn't really tell us anything new, does it?
No. Basically, this is just the continuation of the same narrative. Jeremy Corbyn probably isn't an anti-Semite, but Jeremy Corbyn fails to stand up to anti-Semitism. The long and short of this is just going to further reinforce people's opinions of Jeremy Corbyn. If you are a Corbyn fan, you are probably looking at this and going, oh, well, this is just a lot of fuss over nothing. And indeed, that's the case that's been made by the likes of Matt Zarb-Cousins, who was at one point Corbyn's spin doctor or press secretary or something.
He was the press secretary when Corbyn's leadership was running the worst press operation you've ever seen by any political party.
Yeah. But you've also got Aaron Bastani from Navarra Media kind of saying, oh, this is no big deal. Everybody gets invited into lots of really random Facebook groups, which is true. Like, as somebody who's been involved with an activist in politics for some time, you do get invited to a load of nonsense, but you don't accept them. You get dragged into them and then you leave once you realise, because you don't, if for nothing else, you just don't want to get all the random updates of somebody's saying that this policy is the greatest thing since sliced bread every day for the rest of your lives. On the other side of the fence, you've got people who are fed up of this. You've got people who think that Corbyn needs to do more about it. And this is just another example of Corbyn failing to do anything about anti-Semitism. This is just serving to reaffirm people's existing opinions. And in order to actually win people over, to actually consider voting Labour, of the people who are currently voting Tory, they need to deal with this. Because, you know, it's just not a good look.
I don't really want to do guilt by Facebook association, particularly. I think the problem is actually that people like Owen Jones have. In the past, Owen Jones, he criticised Dominic Raab, who I think is now a housing minister, I believe, for being a member of a far-right Facebook group that had been posting some dodgy stuff. Well, he's been noticeably silent on the Corbyn stuff this week. The problem is the partisanship and the hypocrisy, which I think also turns a lot of people off. So there are six problems that we don't think are going to go away, that we'll probably talk more in more detail on future episodes. We didn't talk about Brexit. In fact, I believe that's the first time that word has been mentioned on the podcast. So you're obviously going to be clamouring for us to talk about Brexit in more detail. Well, thank heavens, listeners. We would like to give our public what they desire. And therefore, our midweek shot, out hopefully Monday, Tuesday, is going to be rounding up the shift in Brexit policy that's happened under Labour and the Tories over the past couple of weeks or so. So stay tuned for that. We'll also hopefully have some stuff on our website, notenoughchampagne.com, as well as on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. I am at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Centre Radical.
James Cram designs our logo, and Dave Deppert is responsible for our theme tune, Pookie Good Times. Happy plotting, everyone.